I'm talking to Bertie Kerr here outside in Enniskillen. Give me the address again. Where again is this place?
Well, it's, there's a road goes, a main road, which is the A32, goes between Enniskillen and Ballinamallard. But this is Mullagh Mean Road here, where you, we're sort of between Enniskillen and Ballinamallard, but we're on a side road, a road that runs parallel with the main road.
How long are you here?
I'm here since 1966.
Right. And where were you before then?
I was in Yarriston beside John McClure, where yeah. John McClure is. He he's married to my sister, and we had a good friend, Johnny Fletcher, who was killed by the IRA on the 1st of March, 1972. And at that stage, my sister was in the hospital on some wee problems she had. And there was a bit of news that there was a UDR man killed in Yarriston, and I didn't know whether it was Fletcher or John McClure, but it had to be some one of the two of them. There were two leading men in that part of the country, and they were in the UDR patrol. But I had to go down to the UDR station. I met with a major. I lost McCool a wee bit, and he told me then that it was Fletcher, you see, and I had to go up to the hospital because I was afraid of my sister finding out, hearing that there was somebody killed in Yarriston and not knowing whether it was her husband or somebody else. So I went up to the hospital and I told her, and she was in a terrible state. But anyway, we decided then that there was no way, there was no cover for them men down there, and it was an out-of-the-way place. It's the most westerly village in the United Kingdom, and you know, we're not far from Ballyshannon. We're on the road to Manor Hamilton in County Leitrim. You had County Leitrim, County Sligo, and County Donegal coming in round us there. And there was no cover for them, and they had no protection. So we decided that they'd have to all move out. A fellow called Willie Long and John McClure, and another fellow, McVitie, George McVitie. And then there was another man George Atchison, the late George Atchison, was there, but George wasn't married or anything, and he was living a good bit away from the border. He didn't move. But they moved away, and we had nowhere to bring them. Only there was a contractor man who was killed by the ARA later on at Baleek, and he had built a new house, and his old house was there, so we moved them up to his old house with very little facilities in it. But eventually got them a house built in Shortshill, and they progressed from there, and they left their farm, and my brother, who was living in Garrison still, right on the border, he took the land off them and kept it for a lot of years. And then eventually John wanted to get back into the farming again, and anyway, he had built we'd renovated a house for him in Church Hill, and he was happy enough there, but he still wanted to get back in to have a livestock and that. So we bought a wee farm for him at Springfield. And when he had that wee farm bought, then he was able to get stock back again, and he built a few sheds and so on. And we cut cider for him for years and helped him along the best we could. Turned out then that he got the buy-in of a couple of sort of half-mountain land, fairly big acreage at smallish money, and we all supported him till he got his bought and things like that. So that's that end of the story. But
you stuck together and supported each other, did you?
Oh, I definitely. I've got into a reasonable way of working here, tractors and machinery and stuff, and I cut sail off of them. And we helped them out every way. I have a brother in Canada who would be a fairly wealthy man, and he would have helped them with finance, but loaned them money and so on. Anyway, they got on well, and the family all grew up, and the son was the youngest of the family, a Richard fella, and he has done rather well this last while. They have a good outfit now at Springfield.
But tell me about your own story, Bert.
Well, my own story was I moved away to Garrison when I joined the Air Force when I was 17. Spent 5 years in the Air Force, and then I came home. And I was passed for the police for the RUC, and didn't exactly fancy the police job.
Why is that?
I'm a bit of a, you know, leave that alone. I don't know what way I could describe it. I would be somebody who doesn't conform altogether one way or another, and had a few bad experiences with police officers one way or another over motoring offences and so on. Anyway, I got offered a job then with post office telephones, which was then the going organisation, and then that again that matured into British Telecom, and I got a job in Belfast. First of all, I was a radio technician in the Air Force. I failed to make aircrew standing, and I passed all the exams to go into that, and we did a whole lot of physical things as well, obstacle courses and God knows what all. I done very well, only to find that in the last leg we had a medical and an eyesight test, and they discovered that I was slightly colourblind between blue and green.
Yes.
And we started off, I think there was about 26, and we were down to 8 fellas, one way or another, that would be considered for aircrew. And I was one of them. So they branded me Colourblind 3 Safe. I don't know if you...
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't say when green went blue or when blue went green.
I see.
Now, I knew all the colours and see them now, but that was what it was branded.
So did you get the job?
Didn't get, no, I didn't make aircrew. Then I went into the radio end of the business and spent a couple of years in Germany on radio telephones and that sort of stuff. And then when I come back, I got the job with BT in Belfast as a technician. And then I went to Belfast for a few weeks and I didn't like it. I'm a country man and it just wasn't me. And anyway, then there was a job came up in Enniskillen, and it was more or less a labouring job, you know, putting up poles and telephone cables and that sort of stuff. But I got on rather well at it, and then the boss brought me in and put me on to a more technical job of fitting switchboards and telephones and that sort of thing. And I done well on that and became, in about, I suppose, 7 years or so, I became general foreman. And I've regressed from that, and we had a big problem in post office telephones and BT and them times, a seniority problem, you know. If you weren't a senior man, you couldn't get promotion and so on. But I broke the mould anyway, and I got promotion fairly early, and then I did an interview for assistant engineer, and I was successful in that. And I ran the business. I graduated till I was running the business here for the last 7 or 10 years I was working. I was running the business in Fermanagh to Roll here for BT. So,
it was quite a long journey, but you got there.
Got a good old pension of it and all the rest of it. Great firm to work for.
But interestingly, you became a councillor.
In 1979, I was in the UDR, and that man that I went to see about who was killed in Jarrison was the name of Batson, if she's come back to me.
Oh, I didn't think you went into the UDR.
I joined the UDR in 71, it was just before Fletcher was killed, actually.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in the same platoon as him. I was in the Enniskillen outfit here. I didn't join John McClure, or I didn't join the people in North Fermanagh here, where I should have probably joined. But I was getting completely messed up, and this man Batson came out one night and he warned us we weren't to go within 3 miles of the border. And I says, that's a bloody ridiculous thing to do. To say, I says, I was reared within 50 yards of the bloody border, and I knew it back to front, and I don't understand why we can't serve. We had a bit of a row anyway, and I said, to hell with this, and I threw in the rifle and left. And I come out then, and a wee while afterwards, a friend of mine came to me and said, Bertie, would you run as a councillor? And I said, well, before that, in the political field, I had not a lot of time for Bill Craig.
Yeah.
Thought Bill Craig was a very straight man. He wasn't a religious maniac like Ian Paisley. He was a genuine man. He'd served during the war and was quite a lot of distinction. And, you know, he made a comment in Lisburnor one night that I was there. There was people giving him a bit of stick there in Belfast, UDA crowd. And he said, I'll tell you this, he said, I was Home Affairs Minister, and if I was Home Affairs Minister at the moment, I'd clear the bloody streets. He said, I didn't give a damn, they were dressed in red, white and blue uniforms. I liked that side of it. You know, to me, Bill Craig was the best politician, in my view, that the unionist people ever had. But like many things, a good honest man like that doesn't always make the grade, you know.
Yes.
And Paisley, of course, was knocking him down, and the Ulster Unionist Party was very much taken over by the aristocracy, and we've seen what happened when they were under pressure. They folded, you know. They didn't handle the thing well, apart from Brian Faulkner. But I was in the Vanguard Party, and I organised it here. In fact, my father and them would have been very soon Ulster Unionists, and I had postal votes for my mother and father.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't give me the postal votes in case I wouldn't vote for Harry West. So, anyway, with my influence one way and another, and John McClure and a few other men like us, we swung the thing around here, and then they wanted me to run for the initial assembly that was run. And we had a meeting one night in Ochre, in an Orange Hall in Ochre, and this man came on the scene called Ernest Baird. He was a Donegal man originally. And he was in a big way in the chemist business in Belfast. And he was too like Paisley from my view, and I didn't like him, but he got nominated anyway, and we got him elected here in Fermanagh and South Tyrone. So the next thing then, come on up about 70, well, up to 79. Anyway, a few friends of mine said to me, Bertie, would you run for the Ulster Unionist Party as a councillor? And I says, no, I couldn't run for you because the hierarchy in Enniskillen wouldn't have me. He says, not up to them. I says, what do you mean? He says, up to you. The four words are not for money. He says, if we want you, Bertie, we'll get you, and that's what's about it.
Yeah.
So I says, well, I don't know about that. He says, how many people's on that? He says, there's ten people from every ward select the councillor.
Yeah.
That's 40 people. And I says, if more of them people come to me, I will run as a councillor. Well, the UDR, in my view, at that time had become, it was nearly an excuse to keep decent men like myself from becoming paramilitaries. You understand what I mean?
Well, that's an interesting point. And
but
did you
understand what I'm saying? We were under that money restrictions, and that money, it was very, very hard job. And then if you were in the UDR, I was running a business, a fairly substantial business at that stage, 100 people on the control.
Oh, this was the Telegraph.
The BT job. Anyway, I says to him, well, he says, what do you want? What do you want to say? Well, tell you what, if a lot of them people comes, and I mentioned a few people that I knew was in it, and they want me to go, so I will go.
Yeah.
But unless you get them people to come, so. Oh, I turned up, I didn't have many people. There must have been 30 people coming to the house here. I want you to go, Bertie. At that time, I was also making odd statements in the media and that, you know, and I was on a programme one night with Olivia O'Leary, and was around the time that was later on, that was 85. But I was on a programme anyway, and the tea man from Cork was the foreign minister in the Free State. And he came on and he said they were making provisions for unionists in Ireland, and there'd be a place for unionists in Ireland and all the rest of it. And I said, what the hell, I might have to come back on that. And he said, so he said, what do you want to say about it? I said, tell you, it's a damn disgrace. What did you call the man there? I can't remember. Anyway, he said,
from Cork, is it?
He was a Cork TD.
Yeah.
He was minister in
the 80s.
Fitzgerald's Parliament. I says, Mr. Fitzgerald, I mentioned the man's name anyway, and I said, he has a bloody cheek to say he'd make room for me. I said, I can trace my family back for 300 years in County Fermanagh. And if I'm not entitled to stay in and live in Ireland, I don't see why the hell he should talk. And I wasn't born in a port. And the place exploded. So the next thing he come back on, and he advised me to come to Dublin. And I says, well, I don't know about that. He says, you come to Dublin, it was Brian Black was the fellow in Northern Ireland. So I went to Dublin and I met the Fine Gael people all. And I got seated in the Taoiseach's chair and God knows what all, and in the Parliament. And they were very good to me. And I put up a fairly sound argument. And I actually got 126 letters from the south of Ireland.
Did you
know? At that stage. Yeah.
So you,
and the, yeah, main, the main theme of them was they didn't think that a unionist like me existed.
Yeah.
You know, I was.
How would you describe yourself now as a unionist?
Well, so, I'm a Ulster unionist. I believe in real politics. I believe in freedom and justice for everybody. They talked about discrimination one day. I was there, all the discrimination in the north? And I said, well, you see, we have a problem as unionists in Northern Ireland. We don't trust the Irish government, that's for sure. They're Republican. And we don't trust the British government, because if it suited them in the morning, I said, I think they'd hand Northern Ireland over to the Irish Republic. And we're between a rock and a hard place, I said, and we're dependent on ourselves, and we're trying to coexist. And when you have the devil here saying, if it pays you to cooperate, cooperate. If it doesn't pay you to cooperate, don't cooperate. And you have the British government agreeing and looking after the Irish Republic to all, in a whole lot of ways. We don't have much choice. We have to stand up for ourselves. And if there was discrimination in Northern Ireland, it was because we have a siege mentality, and that siege mentality is costing us dearly, because there's a bit of alienation of the Catholic community in Northern Ireland that shouldn't be there, but. We have to look after ourselves, and we have to make sure that people in positions of authority are going to be loyal to Northern Ireland. And that's where you had discrimination. And right. People had never heard that before, you know.
Right, but explain to me, in your time as councillor, what were the kind of problems that you were faced with?
With a lot of problems, people were looking to maybe get a house built, you know, way back in way back several years, a lot of years, and the planning was very tight, and the planners were unrealistic to a lot of degrees, and I didn't agree with them. And it didn't matter who the person was, if I became very successful at upsetting the planners. You know, if Joe Bloggs down the road had a son and he happened to be a nationalist or whatever, it didn't matter damn to me, and he wanted to build a wee house on the farm. One of the arguments I used to use quite consistently was, I'd never seen any riots in a town land, you know. So I fought them sort of things, and I had a lot of DHSS things on too. And when I was on the council, first of all, there was an awful lot of council houses.
Yeah.
And people, it was a real pin in the bum, to tell you the truth, but there was people who had a window was leaking a bit, or they had a tap dripping or some bloody thing, and come on, they couldn't get it fixed. They come on to me, I had more things to get sorted. But I got rather good at sorting them, you know, and fairly persistent. And I had a big support, and I was well supported, but it was rough going sometimes, you know, your telephone. Maybe getting into bed and the telephone would ring, somebody had a problem or whatever, you know. As well as that, there was a lot of people being killed one way and another, attending funerals and everything. It wasn't easy at one stage. You know?
So did you find yourself trying to balance both sides?
I was brought up in an area, same as John McClure, where it was 90% Catholic. But we always got on at our neighbour's face well, and my father had a great reputation for helping people out and one thing or another, and that was one of the reasons he was so popular, I think. You know, he wasn't wealthy by any means, and there was 11 of a family in our house, and it was there was nothing that soft about it, but he would have had a few pounds and he'd have been a better manager than most people.
And so, the farm at home, again, like John McClure's, was it on the north side?
On the north side of the border, and running right up the border for maybe quarter of a mile up the border, along the border river.
Was your father educated in the south?
No, my father came from a place called Coral, Derrigunley, about 4 or 5 mile up the road towards Derrigunley, up towards Inniskill. Yeah. And he was the eldest of a family that had their address was Coral, Derrigunley, and Coral was a town land, and originally the Cares of Coral owned the complete town land. Now that had slipped during my father's time, and he married, my mother was an only child, and she was Margaret Bustard, and my father married Margaret Bustard and came to live in Garrison and farm in Garrison. So he bought bits of land and footed a bit, but we lived not too far from, very close to the village.
And did the Carers, you're going back in time, your grandfather and so on, were they always farming that land place?
My mother's place originally. But okay. My father bought bits onto it and so on. Yeah. They got into a reasonable farm, and at that time, it doesn't seem like much nowadays, but he milked 12 or 14 cows, you know.
Yeah.
And we milked them by hand. And
Rearing a family of 11 of you?
11, yeah. First twins were born in 1920, and the youngest girl was born in 1946. It was a brave spread. Anyway, we all got off. We were next to North Leitrim then, just across the bridge in the Irish Republic was North Leitrim. And there was great poverty in the south of Ireland at that time.
Yeah, but Bert, was it always kind of trouble? Was there always trouble?
No, we never had no trouble in our country. Definitely not. And we had a wee orange lodge in that town, and we walked the town in the 12th morning, and there was a lovely old lady, God be good to her, called Daisy Casey, had a hotel and a pub in the village. And she came out with a tray of the old Bendy Leal, took a half on then. She'd come out with a tray of half ones when they were getting on the bus, and give them a wee shot of whiskey before they went to the 12th. Now, she was a good Catholic woman, but. And we got on powerful weather, everybody was poor, or everybody was struggling, and everybody helped each other powerful well. My father was a very handy man at working at cattle and horses and so on, and he was good at used to castrate horses and cattle and castrated and dehorn cattle and things, and he never would take any money off anybody, and the way they paid him back was where he'd be digging a field of spuds, or he'd be making a field of hay, that he would gather around and give him a help, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was the sort of way I was brought up. And I went to, maybe Protestant school closed then, and my father wasn't bad humour about it. He said there was no sense in drawing children away to Belik and so on. So he sent me to the Catholic school. Him and the headmaster, John O'Regan, were good friends. O'Regan had been a man, lived above us in the Free State, and he was the principal in the Catholic school. And I went to the school for 4 years.
What was the name of the school?
Devnish Number 1 Primary, I think it was, in Garrison. And he was a great teacher, but he was an ignorant brute. With the cane. And the worst beating ever I got was for two old friends sat beside me, and they were without putting too much emphasis on it, they weren't a wolf dead. They weren't full shilling, you know, and they were no scholars, like, you know. And they couldn't mind the catechism in the morning. And they got beaten nearly every bloody morning. It was serious. And he had a big lump of a cane. But anyway, there were two of us, Victor Forrest and me, the two Protestants at the school. And we were sitting in the back desk, you see, while they were doing the religious instruction in the morning. And Jim Ferguson was behind me, and Aunt Jim was struggling, and I knew the damn thing as well, off ahead every morning. And I was prompting Jim, you see, like this, and he was getting on rightly. And the next thing I found, I got a whale of a cane across the shoulders, and he pulled me out of the desk. He beat the bloody living daylights out of me. And I said, if you knew your own bloody character as well, you'd be doing perfectly well. You understand the man? Anyway. I had to sit in the front desk from then on, he went and he sat in the back. All them fellas I went to school with and all, they were all very close shit. Now, you know, quite a few of them have passed away, and them two men have passed away. I often do think back, you know.
Yeah.
If that man was going now, he'd get jailed. Like, he was really, he was serious. Serious man with the kin. But he was a good teacher now, and he meant well. And when I was going, and I went to the technical college, and it passed me 11 plus first of all, and the only place I could go was Patora Royal School, and I was 26 or 7 miles from Patora, and there was no such thing as bringing people on buses that time in 1950, and my father would have had to board me in Patora School, and it was, you know, it was a ransom of money every term that he just couldn't afford. I didn't go there, so I went on till I was 14 and a half or 15 in primary school, and then I went to Enniskillen Technical College. You had to do an exam to get into the technical college, and I was first in the technical college exam, so went to the tech then for three years.
You were always you were bright and intelligent, it got you on.
Yeah.
But did you find, though, I'm interested to know, in the council at the time, it was predominantly, it was,
well, when
Ulster Unionists.
When I joined the council,
yeah.
The council was split. There was a couple of Vanguard men, Tommy Scott and Andrew Cannon were councillors from the Vanguard time. I left the Vanguard party in bad humour because they put Bill Craig out one night at a meeting in Lisburn, and it wasn't genuine Vanguard people, it was Paisley people that had moved in to the Vanguard party and upset the Catholic Church altogether. And I left them. I was treasurer at that stage and had looked for money, and they came at me then and said, hey, I'll send the money to headquarters, you're not going to get it. And anyway, one of them down the road, he was a fellow called Bert Johnson, and he was always a Paisley man, but he was in the Vanguard party because Paisley had no standing for man at that stage.
But
they were in there, and there was 9 unionists, and there was 20 councillors. There was 9 unionists and 11, and there was a by-election. And that's when the men came to me to see what I run for the council. So I was the first man to put a speaker on a car. I had a Datsun Bluebird at the time, and I put a speaker on the car, and I went up and down the constituency, and I called in houses that had never seen a councillor in their life.
What was your area?
My area was down here, Ballymallard, Evanstown, Cash, Edenney, Lack, Billick.
And did anybody ever, when you were doing that, did anybody ever take a shot at you?
No, not that time. No. I did later on, but anyway, the Daily Man. I think he may be still alive, that man. He'd go to the south anyway. But he had got into trouble with this woman in the council, he had resigned. Big Ivan Armstrong come to me here, says, you run for the council now. He'd been at me before. And I said, I'm saying, it's a company. So come a lot of people to me anyway. And we had a meeting in Cash, and another man in first called McLaughlin. And when the Ulster Unions, that was in 1979, in 78 there was a general council election. And there ran 4 unionist councillors in North Fermanagh here, and they got 1,600 votes between them. And the Vanguard, the boy in Ballymard ran for Vanguard because I was out of it at that stage, and he got 1,300. They came to me then with a meeting in Cash, in one of the halls in Cash, and they were selecting who would run, me or this man, McLaughlin. And McLaughlin had been one of the ones that run before, you see. And an old friend of mine from Cash was asked, he was the ministry man here, a very good gentleman. He was asked one day in Cash how they make the decision between me and McLaughlin. He said, tell you what, you take a run up round Bertie Kiao's yard, he says, and take a run up round his Irish yard, till the wood of Woodford. So, anyway, the side of that night, there were 40 delegates there, all of them were there.
Yes.
And one of them was a brother-in-law of McLaughlin's.
Yes.
And they got 39 votes out of 40, so...
So he did,
I stepped forward then, they said I wouldn't run unless Colin McLaughlin had signed my forms, and he said he would. So I put on a speaker on the car then, and I really went for it.
How well did you do then?
I got 3,600 votes in North Fermanagh that time, when there was a head count of 3,100 Protestants. But
was it big enough to get you in?
Oh, I need about 1,400 to get in, you see.
So you were in. Did you ever think then of running for as an MP?
Well, it never occurred to me that I wanted to do that. I had my farm at home here. I had a good job in Enniskillen. There was a lot of things against running for it. And then we had a fellow, Sammy Foster, who was big in the Black Preceptor and the Orange Order and things like that. And he actually came to me after I was elected. He said, Bertie, would it be all right if I wonder if I should run for councillor? And he did run.
Yeah.
And he just about got elected that year. But Sammy progressed on, and he had time. My biggest problem was farming. Yeah. I hadn't time. It was my job on the farm. I hadn't time to go running around to various functions and stuff like that, you see. Anyway, I didn't
but,
get
but,
to...
But what did you do to make a difference in your time as a councillor?
Well, I'd done a lot of things. Gerry Burns was the chief executive in Enniskillen, and he was a good chief executive, a smart man. But he was very liberal with what he'd done with money. And the first year I was in, he came to the council with a budget, and I says, no bloody way. There's people up that town there paying serious rates, and you're going to put a figure, he was going to put on 6% on the rates. I said, I'm not bloody having it. There's no bloody way we're going to do that. And I got a bit of backing then from Raymond Ferguson and other men, and he had to go back. And from that day to the day I left the council, whenever the budget was being prepared, I was always brought in before the council meetings.
I see. So you got...
Yeah,
you made a difference that way. What other ways you make a difference?
Well, I made a difference in that I kept a sort of lid on the... Myself and the SDLP men always got on well. Now, Gerry Gallagher from Garrison, the late Gerry Gallagher, was a gentleman, and he was reared in the same town land as me, and his father was a decent man, came from a big family too. And... there was an old man called Jim Lunny in Enniskillen here, who was an SDLP councillor. And he taught me to box when I was going to school in Enniskillen.
Oh, the Kerrs, of course, great boxers.
No, that different Kerr.
Different Kerrs.
But he taught me, a bit of a shindig one night, I stayed with a woman in Enniskillen, Darren Street, and she sent me down to the shop for a loaf and a pint of milk. And there was a lot of boys hanging about the shop, and I want to come out to knock the change out of my hand. And I was gathering up the change anyway, and the boy ate me, and I dropped the bottle of milk and spilled it, and I had a go, had a real good go, took him out right away, and Jim Nunney was coming walking out of the Enniskillen police depot where they had the boxes up, and he says, what's wrong with you, son? He says, you'd be better inside here, we're doing a couple of years, he says, anyway, so... I went back in and I spent a couple
of... So you knocked him out?
Spent a couple of years in the boxing tub. Anyway, Jim gathered it up then, and I was in tears because I was going to have to go back. I hadn't the faint of milk and I hadn't the right change. And all. Oh, he says, come on, son, come on in to Mrs. Rooney. So Mrs. Rooney, give me a bottle of milk. And Jim made up the change that I hadn't got.
That's
and but when I came into the council, me and him had a sort of an unwritten agreement. If our side were talking a load of tripe, we were 10-10 that time. I was back to 10-10, you see. And if our boys were talking a lot of tripe about something, I'd go for a smoke. And when the other boys were talking a lot of tripe, Jim would go for a smoke.
Oh, I see. And that would
that meant they couldn't carry it.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah. That was amazing.
We had a good and Gerry Gallagher. But
your time
Gerry
there
Gallagher and they got on very. His son's a councillor now.
Yeah,
and he. But I did. He's.
You told me you got you bullets fired at you one time. Talk to me about that.
It's not worth talking about. I was down she and my father, he was dying, and there was an ambush for me, but thankfully they didn't get me anywhere.
Talk to me about that.
I'd be well not talking to you too much.
No, let me know. Tell me what happened.
I had a pistol and fired a couple of shots and the hero went onto the grass, let's put it that way. That's all I'm going to tell you. I got away anyway. And the two boys were in Letterkenny Hospital a while after. So I didn't even talk about it at the time. I was very, very sick about people who had been ambushed or something, you know, talking about it and giving the ARA publicity.
Yeah.
I also had a notion that if, you know, I was a character all my own, and if somebody could intimidate me, they could intimidate anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't talk to the media at all about any of them things, because didn't even talk to my own family about it. Because, as I say...
What year? When did this happen?
I think it was 1988. Later on.
And your father was very sick, is it?
Well, no. Getting the bloody years mixed up with us.
Yeah.
I bet. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
I wasn't on
the list until on into the 80s.
Yeah.
And then a boy came on to me one day and he talked to my wife and he talked to my secretary and she was in the hell of a panic station. And eventually he came on to me and told me if I wouldn't put a notice in the paper the following week that I wasn't going to serve the police in the army with telephone service, I'd be considered to be a legitimate target. I think he had to turn off the recorder. I answered him very sharp. I says, I don't know whether you're an ARA man or a crank guy, he says, but if you had as much courage as you have me, he says, come and say that to my face, and I put two effing barrels in you. But
it was I had to be
on my guard after that, knew it was tight, knew they'd be targeted, but again, I didn't talk.
Where were you travelling to?
Well, I was in the office when the bio rung up, and the phone went dead straight away, but... they had me on their list anyway. I was giving them bother in the council as well when they'd come up with something, you know. I wasn't on the council for a period when the Enniskillen bomb went off. I was off for 4 years at that stage because of my job. There was a promotion coming up where you could become area manager, and the deputy general manager of British Telecom had been to see me and he said, look, if you want to take over this job, we can't give you this job and be a councillor. And the wages was coming from the job and one thing another, and I didn't run.
Yeah.
And I wasn't on from 85, 89. So whenever it came up then, what we would have put it, it came up and I got the job. There was people far better qualified than I was as far as qualifications were concerned. At least a half a dozen of them applied for the job. And the interviews were done and nobody was appointed. And the boss came to me and he says, why can we have a lunch? I said, go to the railway hotel. He says, he lifted the briefcase. I said, it's all right. Leave your briefcase there. I locked the door in the office. So. Oh no, he says, I want the briefcase. I want to have a bit of lunch. And he pulled out the briefcase and he handed me a paper. He says, sign that. I said, sign what? He says, sign that there. And I looked at it, it was an application for the area, for the engineer's job. And I said, yes.
An application for?
For the job, you see, for the general manager job. And I said, so the spice for about them, they named four or five of them. He says, you sign that.
Why do you think you got that job?
Anyway, we went to Belfast and I says the wee girl, there were interviews, several men back up again that I knew was well qualified. And, you know, they had great technical certificates and all that I didn't have.
And why do you think they didn't get it and you did?
Well, anyway, we went into the interview forum and I says to how long's them fellas been? And the usher says they're all about 10 or 15 minutes. I was an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And there was a variation of people, from maintenance people to construction people and so on. And the maintenance man made a derogatory remark about the construction people, and they took him on. And I said, look, I can steward records of cables and stuff like that, you see. And I says, look, the biggest problem I have in our country is maintenance men. Instead of clearing a fault on a bloody cable, what they'll do is they'll take a spare pair and they'll leave the bloody faulty pair for somebody else to find. And oh, he couldn't say, that's happening. And it's happening in Belfast, I know it is. And anyway, I got into the argument with him. But I left on here and I went down home. And I was interviewed about 2 years and I was down home before the yard closed. And I needed my own boss, an inspector man. And he says, Bertie, you've got the job. I says, hey, what do you mean? He says, Don McEwan's after ringing me, telling me to tell you. And I says, why the hell did that happen? He says, Bertie, you can manage people. He says, the rest of them, they can manage nobody. They can't manage themselves.
That's
where
he goes. Yeah.
But listen,
I had a reputation for getting things done.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And for...
But in fact, so you were, in fact, traumatised by those bullets going off at you at
well,
that time.
Well, I was, but...
Did that put you on
no,
edge then?
Well, thank God I didn't go on a crazy tour, you know.
Would you have?
Which
did you feel angry
men.
Enough to do that?
Well, I was angry. Now I was angry. I was angry at losing a lot of mates of mine. I lost another very good mate, a fellow called Jimmy Eames. He was there at the corner. He was in my patrol. There was a beaut one night, and I was training for this. Promotion to general foreman at the time. And I was doing NOMA with the planners. When you were training for that, I was good on the construction side and on the fitting side, and 2 or 3 jobs I had done. And then I had to go with planners and see how they worked, and I had to go to exchanges and see how the men were working.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was NOMA training, and I rung the boys and I said, for God's sake, don't be going to the bloody pub now or nothing. They were coming out to protect the power station here on the road where you come out past. And they had a habit of going to the bloody pub for a drink before they went, you see.
Yeah.
Oh, in New Jersey. Anyway, I was getting into bed here and I heard the banger. Jesus Christ, Jimmy Eames and them saying that. It's down there. I jumped into the car and down the bloody road. Oh, such a fucking mess. And I was seen the next one.
Go away. Was he dead?
Mess. Oh, dead. Sure. Blew to pieces.
Yeah.
Well, they gathered him up. Anyway, Alfie Johnson there with him. They were coming out of town. There was an army stationed out here at San Angelo, and they'd been out for a night out, and they were in an army lorry, and the boys were finishing the patrol, and they'd left their car down where Donnelly's garage is now, and they were coming walking down again, and there was an old Austin 1100 backed into a gap on the roadside just as you come down from Cornergrade and come round from that roundabout.
Yeah.
And if I'd have been there, it wouldn't have happened. But Jimmy and Alfie went up to see look at this car, and then the army truck came round the corner and showed them up in the lights, and the boy was up in the bloody field, pressed the fucking button, and the two lads were blew to smithereens. So got Jimmy's arm up the bloody field with his watch still on.
Really? What does that
wife
do
and three
you?
Kids?
How do you get over that?
Oh,
I mean,
I was serious. Jimmy was a mixed marriage. His wife was a Catholic, and Jimmy and I were the two main men in British Telecom at that time. Jimmy was an expert at the cable joint and yeah. distribution, and I was a general foreman. But anyway, she was in a very bad Republican place, lying down the back of Cornergrade there, and I brought her out here and kept her and the kids for a fortnight or 3 weeks till we got her a house in Chanta Hill. And I'd done a lot of things for her. You have to get over it. You have to get on with it, and that's always a bit. And I survived, and Jimmy didn't, unfortunately. But Jimmy had was more or less the same sort of a man as me, and he had the same sort of personality, and he was a fellow who was going to go places. You know, was at that time he was a technician, he was a foreman joiner, but he could have went further. Anyway, his wife they had a big lump of a car, and his wife couldn't drive, and I sold the car for her, and I bought her a wee mini traveller. We were afraid of a bomb attack on the main power station for Enniskillen, which is on our road. and we were doing patrols around it every so often to sort of secure it and make sure there wasn't a bomb put in the power station. But that's where they were out that night. That was their job that night. And one of the reasons I didn't win, to tell you the truth, is because it wasn't going to be very eventful. You know, anyway, Jimmy died, was killed that night, and buried him, and I got rid of the fish she was in, and I brought her out here and kept her for a fortnight, and her and the three kids.
But Bertie, just to finish off, so, I mean, you've retired now from council and all that, and you're just farming here in the land.
Well, I took on a job, you see, in between times there when I was on the council. My son, you see, was David Timber's secretary.
Oh, indeed.
My son David was Timber's secretary.
Oh, sure. Steeped in politics, so.
He's a good club of best. So he's running a good business in Belfast now. He can't afford to go into politics, as far as I can see. But he is one lad that knows the score, and Timber was very difficult to handle, and he had to leave Timber. he got offered a job then with a wee PR firm, can't mind the name of it, there's a wee family firm anyway, and he was working for Timber, not getting a very big wage, and they offered him 35,000 a year, and I'm talking about 14 years ago, I suppose.
Yeah.
And a new BMW car, and you know that's to a young fella. So he got home with me, and he said, I wouldn't leave it. I said, what are you doing? He said, I've been offered this job. And says, he had been telling me about Timber, wouldn't agree with him, and he wouldn't take any advice of anybody. And things. He just walked into one mess after another, Timber, in the later stages. But anyway, he went out of it. He was very much, he's still, I'd like to see him back as an MP or something.
Are you glad?
He knew the score.
He's there. But did he get any...
He knew everything that happened in the Good Friday Agreement.
Did he get any help from you?
Then Trimble was appointing people to the various cross-border bodies. So he appointed me as chairman of the Food Safety Promotion Board.
Oh, did he know?
So I spent 7 years up and down to Dublin and Cork.
Did you?
On the food safety. And I enjoyed that very much for us. It was very good people.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of... in fact, I was the only bloody layman on the whole board. There was doctors and professors and God knows what all. And a wee man, Martin Higgins, who was the chief executive of it, I had a good time for him.
Yeah.
A small wee man. And he was one of them men who did... Never take the book by the cover. He was absolutely fabulous. My first meeting in Belfast, and De Bruyne was the health minister.
Yeah.
Right? And anyway, she got up when we were meeting for the first time, she got up and she started talking Irish. And we found Martin gets off his shit like a terrier. He tapped him, excuse me, Minister, my chairman doesn't speak Irish. And I knew I was in business. And said, there's a man I can work with, you know.
Well, Bertie Kerr, listen, I'm sure I've worn you out, and thank you so
not
much for talking to me. I really appreciate
it. Much telling you much that's not knowledge, you know.
You can see how
but the whole thing very emotional so now, and the Shinners didn't like me in the council now.
Working in the council then, all down through the years, you had, you know, Sinn Féin councillors, there were more and more of them. How did you get on with them?
Well, they went on reasonably well with some of them. There were some of them you just couldn't handle. And in fact, we did. There was a lot of AFA money and European money and things came over. And I was very much involved in putting that fund into good use. And there was a councillor on it, an old man called Martin, and some of them couldn't come in for other sessions during the day. But him and I did a lot of work together. And he came into the town hall one day, and he says, Bertie, we'd had a bit of a controversy, but somebody was looking for more than they were entitled to. And he says, me and you had a hell of a lot in common, Bertie. He says, we're meant to be the same politics. He says, but we don't like smart people telling you get the better of us. You know, but they didn't like me because whenever they talked about economics and they started shouting about it, I said, geez, it's a funny thing. You get to see you boys talking about economics now. You blew the bloody heart out of this town. There wasn't much talking about economics, you know, things like that. But one day they brought in the thing about collusion. You see, collusion of the security forces with the paramilitaries and so on. And two of my colleagues, Raymond Ferguson and Tom Elliott, spoke, and they were kind of half losing the argument, you know. And I said, to hell with this, I'm not going to. And I wasn't down to speak, so I got up and he went, one of our men was in the chair, he was vice chairman, and the Sinn Féin chairman was away, and he wouldn't let me in. So I got out, I said, I'm going to speak whether you like it or not. He said, as far as I'm concerned, there are 9 chinners around that table there, and either you were IRA men or you were IRA colluders, or you wouldn't be Sinn Féin councillors. That's for starters. And there's one of you there, I says, named the councillor in Derrylin, Councillor Martin, I says, and I want to ask you a simple question, and I hope you give me a straight answer. Did you collude with the miserable bastards that put the bomb on the my friend Willie Burley's car at your neighbour's auction? A neighbour of his had been selling out the farm, and Willie Burley went up to buy a couple of cattleland or something, and they put a bomb under his car, and Willie Burley was killed. And he jumped up and he said, I'll get my solicitors. I said, give a shit you get who you get. He says, I'll meet you in any court in Ireland and you'll not want to be there. There was a whole load of sinners to speak, not a one of them opened their mouth.
See, my goodness.
But it's, yeah. people are not treating them like that.
I spoke to Seamus Burley.
Aye.
I did, and he told me about his brother and about the bomb being put underneath his car and killed him.
Well, that councillor Martin lived beside him anyway, did you see? And I just put it out to myself, the hell with you and the colluding. There was a hell of a lot of colluding done with the bloody IRA, and there's no talk about it at all, you know. That's the thing that really annoys me at the present time. And the other thing that annoys me greatly, and I told them several times, if it hadn't been for the provisional IRA starting the murder campaign, there'd have been no soldiers on the streets to make mistakes, there'd have been no policemen making mistakes, there'd have been nobody killed as a result of the Troubles. But they won't take that. Every death that happened in Northern Ireland is down to the Sinn Féin and the IRA starting their murder campaign in Derry. And there was, before Bloody Sunday, there was 2 policemen killed in 1984. They're never mentioned. They're never mentioned. 2 policemen murdered the night before that happened. And you know, if you were in an outfit there like I was, and you get a good mate killed by some dirty owl trick or somebody hiding behind the bushes and shooting them like Johnny Fletcher or whatever, it's damned hard to keep your head the next day you go to the road. You know, if somebody gives you a bit of cheek, you're intending to take them on. You know, it's human nature.
Cheers.
You understand what I mean?
Of course. Yeah. Mm.